Ekatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Ekatra AI. Welcome back to the Deep Dive. I'm really excited about our topic today. We're getting into a book that's made huge waves, especially for, you know, rational seekers. Mm-hmm. It's Sam Harris's Waking Up, A Guide to Spirituality Without Religion.
Oh, it's a significant book. Absolutely. For a long time, it felt like if you were a skeptic, maybe a scientist, or just generally non-religious,
yeah,
you were kind of told that deep meaning, spiritual experiences, those weren't for you. That was religion's territory.
Right.
And Harris just fundamentally questions that whole division.
He really does. Hmm. So our goal today is to unpack his main argument. Basically, that spirituality is rational. It's a verifiable secular thing. It doesn't require any religious faith at all. Zero.
No.
It's written as a guide, really, for people who've maybe walked away from dogma but still feel that pull towards inner change, purpose, maybe even profound experiences.
And it taps right into the modern search for meaning, doesn't it?
Mm.
You hear spiritual but not religious all the time now.
All the time.
It's a huge group of people.
Mm.
And Harris offers them a framework, but it's one based on investigation, experience, not belief.
So let's talk about the man himself, Sam Harris. Many know him as a key voice in that new atheist movement. The end of faith was huge.
Yeah, definitely.
Which makes his focus on spirituality maybe a bit surprising initially.
It can seem that way.
Yeah.
But his approach is, well, it's grounded in science. He actually holds a PhD in neuroscience.
Oh, right. From UCLA.
From UCLA, yeah.
Right.
And his research used brain imaging, fMRI specifically, to look at how our brains handle belief and disbelief,
yeah,
and uncertainty.
So he's literally studying how we decide something's true or not inside the brain.
Exactly.
Okay, so given that really scientific, skeptical background, how does that change how he looks at subjective spiritual stuff? Wouldn't a neuroscientist normally just dismiss it?
Well, that's what's so interesting. He doesn't dismiss the experience itself. He dismisses the, let's say, unsupported explanations that often come with it. Harris is what you might call a contemplative scientist. He took that scientific rigor and applied it directly to contemplative practice. We're talking over two decades of serious meditation. Things like Vipassana and also Dzogchen practices.
Okay, hang on. Can you quickly explain Dzogchen? What's the difference there?
Right. So Dzogchen is pretty central to his argument later on.
Mm-hmm.
Vipassana often involves focused effort, observing things arise and pass away. Dzogchen emphasizes more of a direct recognition of awareness itself.
Recognition.
Yeah, almost like an effortless noticing. The idea is the separation between you, the observer, and whatever you're observing. That distinction starts to dissolve. It's about non-dual awareness.
Non-dual.
And Harris is basically saying, look, I've tested this ancient technology of the mind, as you might call it.
I like that phrase, technology of the mind.
And it produces results,
yeah.
Real psychological insights, regardless of the myths or the religious baggage it might have been wrapped in historically.
Okay, that framing makes a lot of sense. So staying with that idea of intellectual honesty, what's the main goal here? What's the practical point of this whole investigation, according to Harris?
The core idea, the central premise, is that these really profound spiritual states, deep peace, maybe a sense of self-transcendence, just genuine well-being.
Yeah.
These aren't supernatural gifts. They are natural, discoverable features of our own consciousness. Mm. And you can access them through, rational inquiry, first-person investigation.
So he's taking the mystery out of mysticism, in a way.
Exactly. Demystifying it.
Mm-hmm.
And the key mechanism for doing that is realizing, truly experiencing, that our usual sense of self, that feeling of a solid, continuous inside your head running the show, that it's actually an illusion.
Okay. Illusion is a strong word, especially for the kind of skeptical audience he's often talking to. So how does the book work then? Is it just philosophy or?
No, it's both. It's a philosophical argument for sure. But it's also meant as a practical guide. It tries to show you how to arrive at this understanding, this transformation, without ever asking you to believe things without evidence.
Right. A roadmap for exploring your inner life that doesn't clash with the scientific worldview.
That's the promise. An inner life that's both profound and intellectually honest.
All right, let's get into the core ideas then. This is where things get really interesting. He starts by being very careful with words, right? Separating spirituality and religion.
Yes, very deliberately. For him, spirituality with a capital S maybe is that dedicated search for self-transcendence. It's an empirical thing, an investigation you do within your own consciousness.
And religion.
Religion, on the other hand, he defines as a system of beliefs about the universe that are, frankly, unsubstantiated. Usually comes with rituals, group identity, that sort of thing.
So he's saying the search for meaning is valid, even necessary.
Yes.
But accepting claims without good evidence, that's problematic. He wants to, like, extract the useful psychological insights from the old structure.
Precisely. Sift the useful techniques from the dogma.
And the biggest insight he pulls out is this riddle of the self. I thought his description was striking, calling that feeling of a shimmering, rickety film of thoughts and feelings.
It's a fantastic image, isn't it? Because it
yeah.
immediately undermines the idea that the self is some solid thing.
Yeah.
It's not a noun. It's more like a verb, a process that's constantly running, and we mistakenly think there's an owner behind it all.
Okay, but calling the self an illusion, that could really alienate the very rationalists he's trying to reach, couldn't it? Does he offer any, like, scientific backup for such a, well, a traditionally spiritual idea?
He does. He leans heavily on neuroscience here. He talks about the split brain experiments, Michael Gazzaniga's famous work.
Oh, yeah, where they sever the connection between the brain hemispheres.
Exactly. And those studies show, pretty convincingly, that you can have two separate centers of consciousness in one head, sometimes unaware of each other's actions or reasons.
Wow.
Which is powerful evidence suggesting that our normal feeling of being one single unified I is actually a construction. It's a narrative the brain generates. It's not some fundamental entity.
That's pre-mind-bending science actually validating this ancient contemplative insight about the self not being solid. Okay, so if the self is illusory, what is real? He moves on to consciousness itself in chapter 2.
Right. And this is foundational for him, he says. Consciousness is the one thing in this universe that cannot be an illusion.
How so?
Well, think about it. You can doubt whether the world around you is real. Maybe it's a dream, maybe a simulation.
Okay.
But you can't reasonably doubt the experience itself, the awareness of the doubt, or the awareness of the chair, or the dream,
mm-hmm.
that awareness of the one thing you know for sure. It's the bedrock.
The starting point.
The starting point. And he argues we don't need to wait for some final scientific theory of consciousness to explore it. We can investigate it directly, right now, from the inside.
And that brings us to the how, the technique, meditation, which he reframes in chapter 4, right? Not just relaxation.
Exactly. He calls it first-person science.
First-person science. I like that.
It shifts the frame for a rational audience. The goal isn't just to chill out, although that might happen. The goal is systematic introspection, observing thoughts, feelings, sensations as they just appear, without getting swept away by them, without identifying as them.
So it's not about stopping thoughts, but seeing them differently.
Precisely. Recognizing that the awareness in which thoughts appear is actually more stable, more fundamental than any particular thought or feeling that comes and goes.
And if you practice that consistently, that's what leads towards that non-dual awareness you mentioned earlier, where the observer-observed split dissolves.
That's the path he lays out, yes.
Mm.
But importantly, while he's advocating for these potentially transformative practices, he keeps his critical hat on.
Right, he has that chapter on intellectual honesty.
Yeah, chapter 5. He warns about spiritual pitfalls. The ego latching onto spiritual achievements, getting fooled by charismatic charlatans, the whole guru scene.
Mm-hmm.
He's essentially saying, yes, explore deeply, but please don't check your brain at the door. Critical thinking is essential on this path, too.
It's a crucial warning. Pursue the profound, but stay skeptical of extraordinary claims and personalities.
That's the balance he strikes. Discernment is key.
Okay, let's pull back a bit now. Thinking about the whole book, what are the big takeaway messages, the things that really stick? I see maybe three main themes emerging. First one, the self is the source of suffering.
Yes. That constant identification with this fragile, constructed ego, the me, means we're perpetually defending it, comparing it, worrying about
it. Yeah, always anxious.
That attachment, that identification, he argues, is the fundamental root of so much of our psychological distress. Seeing through it doesn't eliminate pain, maybe, but it changes your relationship to it profoundly.
Okay. And the second big theme seems to be the primacy of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. The idea that this field of awareness, just this open space where all experiences happen, is the unchanging background of our entire lives.
Right.
And therefore, training the mind to recognize this awareness, to rest as this awareness. Harris would say that's the single most important skill you can develop.
Because it affects everything else.
It affects every single moment of experience.
Yeah.
It's the highest leverage point. And that leads right into the third theme, which really sums up the whole project. Spirituality as technique.
Meaning, It's about doing, not just believing.
Exactly. The most valuable spiritual insights don't come from accepting doctrines or having blind faith. They come from developing specific skills.
Skills of attention.
Skills of attention, skills of awareness. It's framed as an empirical investigation, something you do and observe the results of, which makes genuine spirituality totally accessible, even necessary, for rationalists. It's practice, not belief.
Harris has such a direct way of putting things, almost clinical sometimes, but very clear. Let's maybe highlight a few specific lines or ideas that really capture these points.
Yeah, his phrasing is often incredibly precise. Okay, first, consciousness is the one thing in this universe that cannot be an illusion.
We touched on that. Its power is in establishing that undeniable starting point, right? Experience itself is real, even if its contents are questionable.
Precisely. Then, the one about the self. The feeling that we call I is itself a thought arising in consciousness.
That one lands hard. It just deflates the ego.
Completely. It reframes the I not as the thinker, but as just another thought, like a cloud passing in the sky of awareness, not the sky itself.
Wow. Okay. And finally, the one that makes it all practical. Spirituality is not a matter of belief, but of technique.
That sums it all up, doesn't it? It immediately casts the whole endeavor as skill acquisition. Like learning an instrument, almost. You practice, you get better, you perceive more nuance. You don't need to believe in supernatural claims about the piano. You just need to practice playing it.
Okay, so let's make this really concrete for people listening. Beyond, you know, signing up for a 10-day retreat, how can someone apply these ideas in their everyday life, say, tomorrow morning?
I think the most immediate application is in emotional regulation. We all get triggered, right? Stuck in traffic, maybe, or dealing with a frustrating email.
Oh, yeah. Road rage is a classic. That feeling of just being totally consumed by anger, how does observing it actually help in that moment?
Well, the practice Harris suggests is to shift from I am angry to anger is being felt. You notice the raw sensations, the heat rising, maybe tightness in your shoulders, the specific thoughts racing through your mind.
So you treat the anger like weather, a storm passing through.
Exactly. You observe it as energy and sensation patterns within consciousness rather than identifying with it, becoming it. And just doing that creates a little bit of space, psychological distance.
And that space is crucial. It leads to reduced reactivity, right?
Mm-hmm. That little gap between the trigger, the person cutting you off, and your hoop patrol reaction gives you a choice. You don't have to automatically yell or spiral. You develop more resilience, more emotional intelligence.
Makes sense.
And then, maybe more subtly, Harris argues this whole process fosters increased compassion.
How so?
When you start to see your own sense of self as this kind of flimsy, temporary construction, the boundary between me and you starts to feel less absolute, less rigid. You recognize others are caught in similar patterns of egoic suffering. It can naturally soften tribalism and just, well, increase empathy.
That's a powerful potential outcome. For me, looking back at the book, the most surprising thing was seeing how robustly modern neuroscience, like that split brain stuff, actually supports these insights that contemplatives have been talking about for like millennia.
It really is a striking convergence.
Reason and inner experience pointing the same way.
It is. And that's the book's great achievement, I think. It lays out a credible, intellectually honest path for deep self-exploration. It says, yes, you can be a thoroughgoing rationalist, a materialist even, and still tap into these profound states of well-being.
Which brings us to a final thought for you, the listener, to maybe ponder. Harris positions the investigation of consciousness not just as philosophy or religion, but as a vital frontier for human growth. So the question is, could developing these first-person skills, this inner science of awareness, offer a foundation for meaning and ethics that's maybe more sustainable, more grounded in reason, than relying solely on traditional faith or purely abstract logic?
Definitely something to think about until next time.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.